You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, you're going to love it. Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. Hope that you had a great weekend, especially if you've got a graduate. I've got a preschool graduate myself. My niece graduated from high school in New Jersey this week and is off to college in Los Angeles. So if you are a graduate or you have a graduate, I'm sending my love to you, especially those parents who are like, oh my God, when is this year going to end? I am saluting you and with a great episode. Imagine how excited I was when I met my son's new friend's father this year, and he told me, oh, I work in unscripted TV. I just thought to myself, is there a TV god? And if there is, do they see me right now? Because he is a famed unscripted creator and executive producer who has worked on a ton of great shows. So Kent Weed is one of my guests today. He created shows including American Ninja Warrior, which is this incredible sports entertainment competition based on the Japanese television series Suzuki, and it features hundreds of competitors attempting to complete a series of insane obstacle courses of increasing difficulty in various cities across the U.S. in hopes of advancing to the national finals on the Las Vegas Strip and becoming the season's American Ninja Warrior. It is a great show for the entire family. Unbelievable athletes, wonderful personal stories, such a great show to watch. Hell's Kitchen is a reality competition series hosted by celebrity chef Gordon Ramsay, who created and appeared in the British series of the same name. So each season, two teams of chefs compete for a job as head chef at a restaurant while working in the kitchen of a restaurant set up in the TV studio. A progressive elimination format reduces a field of 20 to 12 to a single winner over the course of each season. So in a typical episode, a single contestant is selected for elimination. Gordon Ramsay is a British chef, restaurateur, TV personality and writer, born in Scotland and raised in England. He founded his global restaurant group, Gordon Ramsay Restaurants, in 1997, and it's been awarded 16 Michelin stars in total and currently holds a total of 7. After rising to fame on the British TV series Boiling Point in 1999, he became one of the best known and most influential chefs in the UK by 2004. But as a reality TV personality, he's really known for his bluntness, as well as a fiery temper, strict demeanor, and his frequent use of profanity. You're sweating buckets while you watch the show. You're cringing because he says the most insane things and the contestants are stressed out. If you like high intensity shows and cooking shows, this is a marriage of the best order. He combines activities in the TV, film, hospitality, and food industries and has promoted and hired various chefs who have apprenticed under his wing. Definitely one to watch too. Hell's Kitchen. American Ninja Warrior and Hell's Kitchen are currently premiering new seasons. So you can get in right now at the ground floor and start watching. Now, Kent has also been involved in two other shows that I continue to be mesmerized by. Trading Spaces, in each episode, two sets of neighbors redecorated one room in each other's home. Each two-person team had two, later 3 days, a budget of $1,000, which later became $2,000, and the services of a designer, and then both teams in early seasons shared one carpenter, while later on each team had a carpenter. So imagine your neighbor down the street, they decide they're going to redo your family room, and you don't have any say in who that designer is or the carpenter they're using. And after spending 24 hours pretty much a day painting and rebuilding pieces of furniture in their house, you walk over to your house, open the door, and you might love what they've done to your house, or you might hate it, and it's on you to do something about it afterwards. And in a great show, one to watch. And then the other one is this little sleeper hit that I've been obsessed with because it aired in 2003 when I first moved to Los Angeles. And since I didn't have any friends, I watched this show, and it would air a couple days each week. And I was totally sucked into it. It was such a great show. It was called Paradise Hotel. So in this show, a group of singles lived in this luxurious hotel resort, which Kent will later tell you was just actually a house, competing to see who can stay in the hotel the longest. So each week, the contestants paired off into couples, and they had to share a hotel room together. So when one person is left over, he or she must either pair up in the following episode or leave the hotel to be replaced by a new contestant. So it was like the early version of, let me pretend I'm into you because that's the only way I can stay on the show. And if I stay on the show, I can possibly get the cash payout in the end. I still can't stop thinking about that show. I loved it. And it like I said, it aired in 2003, but Fox tried to revive it in 2019 with Kristen Cavallari, but they canceled the series after like a month. I just don't think it was as good as the original. So those are all great shows to watch. And then I also had Jay Edelson back because there's a new Hulu documentary that just aired Monday. It's called The Housewife and the Hustler, and it talks about the legal problems of Erica Girardi of Bravo's The Real Housewife of Beverly Hills and her now estranged husband, one-time power lawyer Tom Girardi. Remember, she filed for a divorce on Election Day, and it was weird, especially if you watch Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, because just 4 days before, she was on a trip to Lake Tahoe with her castmates, and she's spoke about him in loving terms. So it's just odd that 4 days later she filed for divorce. And then, of course, we find out that there's all this other story that's going on. So I asked Jay to come back on the show because he watched the Hulu doc, but also because he is the person that filed the federal lawsuit against Tom and Erica Girardi and is considered one of the nation's leading plaintiffs' lawyers. So I was eager to talk to him about updates on the case. So, here we go. My friend Jay Edelson is considered one of the nation's leading plaintiff lawyers. He filed a federal lawsuit against Tom and Erica Girardi and is mentioned in the Hulu documentary briefly, The Housewife and the Hustler. We've both watched the documentary, and I've asked him to come back to the show to discuss the case's latest updates. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
I just feel like this case gets crazier and crazier by the minute. Now, Los Angeles Times report has reported that the State Bar of California acknowledged this week that its investigators have mishandled years of complaints against disgraced legal titan and Real Housewives of Beverly Hills cast member Tom Girardi. The stunning public admission by the agency that regulates the state's legal profession comes after a Los Angeles Times investigation published in March describing how Tom Girardi had kept his law license pristine despite numerous complaints against him at the state bar, as well as more than 100 lawsuits against him and his firm, many of them alleging misappropriation of funds. How in the world did this happen?
Okay, this is why I love being on your podcast and speaking to you. That's exactly the question. So the key thing that I want the press and the world to examine is not just, you know, the salacious stuff of Erica Jane getting tens of millions of dollars for a singing career. That's fun. We can all watch that. But the bigger thing is Tom has been stealing money from clients for apparently decades and a lot of money. And the California bar knew about it. other lawyers knew about it, judges knew about it, and nobody did anything. And so then the next question is yours, which is why? And the reason is because of the incredible amount of influence he had. And influence meant money and power, and he used that. And I appreciate the California Bar's mea culpa, but it's a little bit late, and it didn't come with anything. They didn't say, here's why it happened, and here's what we're fixing. Instead, they had to put out a statement because the LA Times just destroyed them, as it ought to. And hats off to the LA Times. But this, we really need to, and I say this as a plaintiff's lawyer, we need to have a really hard look at plaintiff's law to understand, you know, how this happened and make sure it doesn't happen again.
And what is the discussion within the legal industry? Are people sort of admitting that they were taken with his charm or his power? Or is everybody just kind of run into the corners like, I had nothing to do with this?
It's the latter. It's really awful. And before we filed the suit, we were told, don't do it. Don't go after Tom. He's too powerful. He's going to retaliate against you. Nothing's going to be done. And it's going to put a spotlight under the plaintiff's bar, which is going to be bad for everybody. And that's basically been the reaction. I've gotten a number of kind of private emails and phone calls saying, hey, great job, Jay. But publicly, the major players in the plaintiff's bar are either staying silent or saying, oh, don't worry about it. This doesn't really reflect any real problems in the plaintiff's bar. And they're just totally wrong. First, you know, I don't believe in normal interviews. So I'm gonna start by asking you, what do you think of the documentary?
I thought it was pretty cheesy. I questioned some of the choices for the experts that they brought in. It seemed quite flashy. I like more of like an old school documentary.
Yeah, Christopher Darden being on was interesting. And really all of the commentators were not people who live in this world. Brian Kapitek is a plaintiff's lawyer who does know, you know, what he's talking about. So I thought he was fine to have on. But I agree with you. A lot of the other ones, it just didn't really make sense. But I couldn't tell. For me, it just didn't break any new news, but I didn't know if I'm just so much in the weeds. But I was kind of disappointed by it. The one thing I felt that, well, there were a lot of things I felt the documentary missed, but one of the major things was kind of how Tom comported himself over those years. He still kind of in some ways seemed like kind of a sweet guy, his demeanor. He has two gears. One is this sweet, charming guy, which is a facade. And the other is someone who's really vindictive and threatens and is really, really nasty. And that's part of how he got away with all of this. My understanding is that, you know, a lot of the judges he had close relationships with didn't actually like him. They were just really scared of him because of his incredible amount of power and the fact that he was willing to wield it in awful, awful ways.
But I also feel like in the clips that they showed of each other, where they were interviewed by a female reporter in their home, I see a scared Erica. I see someone who walks on eggshells. I see someone who is allowing him to talk and she takes a back seat. So it also makes me wonder what happened behind the scenes in their home, because it does not seem like that was a marriage of equals.
I will go to my grave saying that Erica's the smarter of the two of them. I fundamentally believe that. My view of Tom is that he has such a fragile ego. Right. So it is really, really hard to relate to him because he's either threatening or promising or trying to ingratiate himself. But at the same time, he is so hypersensitive that if you say anything he might view as an attack, it is just like, it destroys him. So yes, I understand the walking eggshells around him. I didn't do that because I was scared of him. I did that because I didn't want him to kind of fall apart. So I wonder, I have no idea what their relationship was like, but she played him pretty well. I mean, oh my God, how much money did she get from him to further her career, money which he didn't even have. I don't view her as a victim in this. I view her as kind of, you know, she was kind of conning the con man.
Back to the settlements, do you think it's possible that he lowballed some of these settlements for these victims?
Well, what do you mean by lowball? Like he took a smaller amount?
He took a smaller amount just to move through the process quicker. Because some of these clients, they were pushing him for a settlement. And perhaps in his haste, he didn't do right by the client.
Well, that's hard to know because you've got to really understand a specific case, and clients often want more money than the value of the case. I can tell you in the Lion Air cases, when we negotiated it, and the documentary made it seem like he was negotiating the Lion Air case. He wasn't actually involved in those cases. His involvement was stealing the money. He didn't show up to any of the mediations. No one wanted him at the mediations. It was me and one of his partners. And there was absolutely no pressure to take a lower settlement.
Okay.
I think, but I don't know about people's specific situations. The most dangerous thing is to have an attorney who has fallen apart financially, because then they're motivated by their kind of, you know, specific emergent financial situation and might care less about their client. It's one of the reasons why you want to hire for someone like Tom Girardi or a successful plaintiff's attorney, because they're not supposedly not worried about money and they can hold out for a really good settlement. So that may have happened in cases. I think the bigger problem was that when the money came in, he viewed it as his own and he played so many games, and that we haven't scratched the surface of the way in which he stole money from clients. It wasn't just like Lion Air where he just took the money. It was also situations where, in my belief, and we haven't proven this yet, he would get a settlement, let's say for $15 million, and then tell the client, we're going to set it up so you're paid over time. Mm. But really, he was using that money and was kind of screwing them over in those ways. And you heard a little bit of that in the documentary, some stories. I think that's the bigger problem over accepting lowball settlements. But again, I don't know. I mean, that I would have to kind of study the specific cases.
So it's my understanding that they have someone combing through episodes now, taking notes on her personal possessions. Does she get to keep the items that she said were gifts, like her engagement ring or some of the jewelry?
We'll see how it plays out. The theory of our case, so we have named Erica Jane as the defendant in our action, is that she was basically taking client funds and using it to fund her lifestyle. And if we're successful in that, that means that we're going to be able to get whatever possession she has back in order to pay off any sort of judgment. So there's no exception of, you know, this is a price, this is a valuable piece of artwork, so I want to keep it.
Right.
The law doesn't work like that. I mean, it gets really nasty. When you get a judgment and someone doesn't want to pay, you literally can depose them and say, we want to go through your purse. Take out the possessions in your purse. What is that? You know, that is no longer yours.
Wow.
It gets really, really nasty. Those are keys to what car? We want to understand what car it is. So, you know, wow. Erica's strategy so far has been to just kind of ignore this lawsuit.
Right.
I don't think that's going to work out well for her, but we'll see.
Especially when you see these episodes where they're talking about $1 million piece of art on their walls. What about all the possessions in the home? I know that the home is now up for sale. What happens to all of that?
I think everything's going to be auctioned off. I know that that's happening with the stuff that is his office. His office, which was, you know, a shrine to Tom Girardi.
Of course.
And I don't know who would buy that, right. Different things, but they'll auction that stuff off. And I don't know, maybe Erica's going to hire really good lawyers and is going to be able to keep some of it. But I think that's an uphill battle.
What documents did Erica sign that could put her in a precarious legal position? And if so, which ones?
I don't want to get into kind of the specific, you know, theory of our case and how we're going to prove it. I can tell you in general that that we believe we're going to be able to prove that Erica was incredibly involved in in the business, not just the law firm, but also he was loaning money to her company, tens of millions of dollars to her company. And we think that money came from client funds. And we're going to look into all of that. And that's all going to be, you know, part of the proof that we showed to a jury that she was knee deep in this fraud. And she can say, oh, she didn't know anything about it. I think that's going to be hard for her to convince a jury of.
So it said Erica was allowed to delay being deposed twice, and in September, just before shooting began. So September of 2020. Then she files for divorce November 4th, I believe, Election Day. She started filming in October, and we see her on camera October 28th and 29th in Lake Tahoe talking about him in seemingly lovingly terms. What understanding do you have behind the scenes, maybe something that we don't know, about the timeline and whether or not this, all of this sort of sideswiped her? Why would she file for divorce 4 days after a trip where she's on camera saying how great he is?
Well, I mean, you know this way better than I do. The fact that a reality TV star says something on camera doesn't mean that it's what she believes. You know, that's just part of her act. And I don't say that in a derogatory way. Reality stars, you know, they are acting in a lot of senses. One of the things the documentary got right was talking about why we decided to file suit against them. And it was all because Erica filed for divorce. That when she filed for divorce, we realized that that she probably was doing that because the money was gone. And that seems like her instincts were right about that. But the fact that she's making other public pronouncements doesn't mean a lot to me. In the same way that when she then later came out and said, oh, the reason I am divorcing Tom is because he cheated on me with the judge 10 years earlier. You know, I heard that and I just kind of shrugged and said, this is all just kind of TV nonsense.
Will there be an independent medical doctor's evaluating his mental health for confirmation of his Alzheimer's diagnosis?
So thanks for asking the question that way. What, this is such a joke that now it seems like a lot of the media has just bought into the fact that he actually has Alzheimer's. So I'm not a doctor. I don't know. But what I can tell you is that it seems very convenient. And if you, when we put out the kind of the facts that we found through our investigation of the types of things he was trying to do during the time he had Alzheimer's, where he was really scheming. He was scheming to protect himself from the fraud. He was scheming to try to keep as many possessions as possible. He was scheming to try to sell cases that he had in the pipeline to other firms to try to get out. Yes. These are things that take a level of sophistication. He was offering me what I perceived as bribes in order to drop the suit. You know, that it did not feel to me like I was speaking to someone who was mentally incapacitated. So I just think the media has it wrong.
Also, correct me if I'm wrong, but weren't there audio tapes where he was calling and berating people, that people saved voicemails? And it seems to be not too far long ago. So if somebody had that sort of diagnosis, I doubt that they would make phone calls or voicemails like that.
Yeah, we have a slew of them, which we've turned over to the federal prosecutors, where he is, for us, he was not trying to threaten us. He was trying to ingratiate himself or bribe us. And basically told us that he has very close connections with judges and He can make us another $1 million. That was the quote in the voicemail. Jay, if you drop the suit, I'll make you another $1 million because of my close connection with judges. So yeah, there's an incredible amount of evidence out there. He was speaking at lawyer events right before the lawsuit. There's right. some on YouTube and then some that were separate where, you know, he was the same old Tom that he was, you know, 5-10 years ago. So this all just feels like kind of crap to me.
And where does the status of the conservatorship now?
I think he's contesting it right now.
Yeah, we're right.
Which is interesting. So we'll see how that plays out.
She said in that Lake Tahoe episode, in a game of truth, two truths, one lie, that she wore a wire in a federal investigation. Do you have any knowledge about this? And of course, the question is, it's not part of this investigation, is it?
If I did have knowledge of it, I would tell you I couldn't comment, but I can comment because I don't have any knowledge of it. I don't know what, I had no idea what she was talking about.
Yeah.
The idea, and I want to be clear, I'm a civil attorney. I'm not working with the prosecutors. I'm obviously giving them whatever information they want, but they don't tell me about their investigation, that I don't have inside knowledge about their thought process. It, to me, though, as someone on the side, there's no chance she was wearing a wire against Tom. If to the extent she was kind of insinuating that couldn't possibly be true.
Yeah, a lot of people just feel like a lot of the comments that she's making thus far this season are very calculated. As someone involved in the case and watching from the sidelines, do you get that same sense?
They're calculated, but not calculated in a smart way. Like they're calculated in order to curry some immediate public favor. So that seems what she's mostly concerned about, which is maintaining her kind of her status as a reality star and kind of the victim and these types of things. And she's doing that very well. She's very savvy. I think her lawyers are probably, you know, I don't know, having, you know, going to the bar every night and having a lot of drinks and going, oh my God, what is she doing? Not helping her in terms of all of her legal problems.
Do you foresee that this is going to become an even larger legal headache for her?
Yes. So, okay. I personally don't think that she, if I were her attorney, and I'm so glad I'm not, I would not be terribly concerned about the criminal ramifications. I would be kind of surprised if she was the focus of that. But again, I'm not a criminal attorney. I'm not a prosecutor, and they've got a lot more information. The civil stuff would be very scary for me because more and more clients are coming out of the woodwork, and we're finding out how much money Tom stole. And to the extent that she's going to be brought into all these other suits, that's going to be very difficult for her. The attorney's fees alone are going to be incredibly substantial. And for our case, we think that we're going to win. And, you know, is she someone who's going to be able to pay multi-million-dollar judgments? I'd be surprised.
Is there anything that we should be paying attention to in the next couple of weeks or months, like the next big part of the timeline?
So we have two cases going, and we're starting to get into depositions. And that's where really the fun happens, where we're going to be deposing some. The first thing we expect will be deposing people who really know where the bodies are buried. And we expect to be deposing Eric as well. And Tom. That's where the rubber meets the road. She can say whatever she wants on her reality show. But when she's under oath, we're going to see a totally different Erica Jane. And I cannot wait to take that deposition.
Okay, the last question or the last part of this is I'd like for you to just talk about the victims and just remind people about the magnitude of the personal and financial loss of the victims.
Yeah, and people go to plaintiff's attorneys often when they've experienced the worst tragedy of their life. So we're talking about burn victims, people who lost, you know, parents or kids, people who are paralyzed for the rest of their life. And you hire someone like Tom in order to get some amount of justice. And that process of getting that justice is emotionally tolling. It is very difficult on someone to go through a lawsuit. So they get a result, $20 million, and they say, okay, I can put this chapter behind me. I can start healing. I can set up my family so that we're financially secure. There's an incredible amount of relief there. When then they find out that their hero, the person they hired to get this money, actually stole it and they're getting nothing, they've been re-victimized. It is so deflating for them. It is hard to even, we're representing some of the victims. We're doing it pro bono. We're not going to take money from them. And you're dealing with someone who's re-traumatized. People who don't believe in the American legal system. And it is horrible. It is, I just can't imagine a worse thing a lawyer can do. It's really horrible.
Well, I'm thanking you for all the hard work that you and your firm are doing to help the victims. Is there a chance that they will see any financial payouts at all? And if so, my understanding is in these cases, sometimes it could take years.
Well, I mean, we're really pleased that one of our clients was unable to get settlement money for a significant injury. It was tens of millions of dollars owed, and we were able to get him the money within a matter of a couple months. I can tell you during those couple months, it was the amount of anxiety and stress that he had because he had been counting on this money was, you know, it was enormous. So I feel so bad for the victims who may be on a slower path. I do believe that the victims will see some money. I'm very concerned that a lot of plaintiff's attorneys are viewing this as an opportunity to make a ton of money off of the victims. And I really kind of urge the plaintiff's bar in general that, you know, this is such a blight on the work we do that we really should not be making money off the victims. You know, we should be doing this because we believe in plaintiff's work. But if someone loses $2 million from Tom and you get them $2 million back, you shouldn't be taking 35% of it or 40% of that. They should get the full $2 million, especially if you're not going to get the full amount because of all these bankruptcy things. So I really am making a public call on the plaintiff's bar to put their short-term financial interests aside. And, you know, we should be doing this pro bono. We should help the victims and kind of show the country the good side of the plaintiff's bar, because Tom's done a terrific job of showing how bad it can be.
Absolutely. Tell everybody where they can find you and learn more about your firm.
You always ask me this question, but I don't know. I'm on Twitter. Jay, I don't know, at Jay Edelson. How does Twitter work? You know.
Well, your firm is Edelson PC.
Thank you. That's good. Yeah, we're around. If you do a search for me, I come up.
Well, thank you always. And I look forward to having you back.
Thanks a lot. This was fun. And I really appreciate the work you're doing and the approach that you have. I think it's really important.
Thank you, Jay. Kent Weed is an Emmy-nominated director and producer known for his television work in the talk show, reality, game show, and variety of genres, spanning shows such as American Ninja Warrior, Hell's Kitchen, Unsung, Trading Spaces, and one of my most favorite shows of all time, and he knows this, Paradise Hotel. You became interested in entertainment as a young boy when you worked on music videos with your dad, Gene, who was a famous disc jockey and successful producer for Dick Clark Productions, What is it about entertainment that really grabbed your attention?
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, I actually fought going into the business, but probably because my father was in it. But I did enjoy working with him on the sets when we were shooting those music videos. But because we had a little bit of a struggle as a child, you know, our childhood was a little bit, you know, I guess the best way to put it, it was difficult. Mm-hmm. So family life wasn't great. So I think I probably resented that a little bit in the beginning. But I got into television because I was really, I saw things in pictures. I saw things very visual. And so I was very attracted to being able to tell stories through pictures. And I started in the bottom. I didn't want to use my, you know, father's reputation or, you know, travel on his tailcoat, so to speak. So I worked my way up from a PA all the way up to, you know, becoming a director. You know, by the time I was 27, I was directing, you know, network shows. So I took it real easy. I worked real hard at it, and I fell in love with it. So
what's the most memorable music video that you worked on?
Oh, well, actually, it wasn't a music video. It was a music video per se, but it was shot in a live context. It was with Michael Jackson, the Earth song.
Wow. And
it was done at the 1997, I think it was, or 95 World Music Awards.
Wow.
And it was the first time that song had ever aired. And it was quite a production that we put together with a big globe that separated. He came out through the middle and kids all around and all that stuff. And we went to London to edit it. And Michael was in the edit bay with me, and he didn't sleep. We worked like 36 hours straight. And it turned out great. It turned out really, really good. And I was very proud of that. And that's probably the most memorable one because I directed it myself. The ones my dad did, I mean, I just, you know, they're not as memorable. I mean, the names are. I mean, Leonard Skinner and Steppenwolf and Debbie Boone and those kind of people, you know, in that era.
But, yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about how you came up with the concept for American Ninja Warrior, because this show is a massive hit.
Yeah, it is a format that was in Japan called Sasuke. And there was an executive at G4 who was we used to work with my partner, Arthur Smith. And he brought this project to us, this idea, you know. And we said that, listen, we could do this, and gave us very little money in the beginning. And it was, you know, G4 was primarily a male network and skewed towards, you know, mm-hmm. you know, I think it was 85-90% male. So the original show was very, you know, male dominant driven, and it was comedic with Japan, and was somewhat rudimentary obstacles. And what we did is we took that, like we've done with other formats, and re-engineered it and created American Ninja Warrior. And it was obviously, it was what made the difference was we were telling stories of people overcoming obstacles in their lives to compete on the hardest obstacle course in the world. So it was the stories behind the people that really resonated with our audience and broadened the format out. And we went from being predominantly male. We were on three different networks. We were on G4, then Esquire, then NBC. By the time we got to NBC, we were predominantly female viewers. It totally flopped because of the storytelling. And of course, we put a lot of production value into it. We, you know, improved the obstacles and designed a bunch of new obstacles and just kept telling great stories.
And you're responsible for every aspect of the show. I mean, you've got your hand in just about everything, don't you?
Yeah, that's very true. From the day one, I was very instrumental in designing the courses and coming up with the obstacles. I used to test all the obstacles myself in the beginning. And they were much easier back then, and the ninjas weren't as good yet. And so, but now, you know, I've gotten a little older. The ninjas have gotten better. The obstacles have gotten really difficult and very hard. It's become a very niche sport, and you have to train specifically for it. So. But yeah, from the designing the courses and putting together, you know, the layout and coming up with, you know, which obstacles go where, and of course the casting and finding our, you know, our great stories every year.
How hard is the casting? Is that the hardest part of it, or is the actual development of the obstacles the hardest part of it?
You know, I think it's all, it's kind of a machine now, so I don't know if there's anything really hard about it. There's always a ton of, you know, people that want to compete on the show. We get thousands and thousands of submissions every year. And it's not really that hard to decide. We want to bring back people, returners, obviously, and we don't always tell news stories. So it's just, you know, sometimes we can't tell everybody's story, and we can't cast everybody. But we look for, you know, people that have, you know, really good, interesting story. You know, what obstacles are they overcoming in their lives? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't want necessarily just people that are, you know, 100% gym rats, you know.
Right.
Because that there's not much depth to that story. We have a few of those, obviously, but it's more interesting, I think, to tell stories of people, and that's what inspires other people to do this, you know. And I always say it's the show that gets kids away from video games and parents off the couch and families playing together again in the backyard, and you know, I'm very proud of that part of the show, and it's made a difference in a lot of people's lives, and I really see it as this whole grassroots following that's grown exponentially over the last, you know, especially the last 5 years. And there's gyms all over the country. And, you know, you just hear about it all the time. The people, you know, are out there doing it. So, you know, we've actually talked about, you know, we played with the idea of making it an Olympic sport somehow, but there's a lot of hurdles to, pardon the pun, come over.
Right. For that. That would be incredible. Well, I had one of the former contestants wrote me last night, and she said, I'm always impressed with how you're able to tell so many different stories through the casting.
Yeah.
I mean, you really have been able to highlight some extraordinary stories. Are there any that really have stayed with you that just, like, they stuck?
Michael Stanger from Kansas City a few years back. It was probably 4:30 in the morning. And we were just about done with everybody. And there was a huge thunderstorm bearing down upon us. And I was following it on the radar. And in the control room, and I was trying to figure out, you know, I said, we got to go. We got to wrap. And one of the main casting guys came up to me and said, we've got this guy. He's in the walk-up line. He's been waiting. He's got, you know, his wife is here in a wheelchair, and we have to run this guy. And he's amazing. And so we did. And, you know, I didn't think we'd get his run in because I thought that the storm would dump on us any second. He took to the course. His wife is on the sidelines, and she had this disease, this debilitating disease, which kind of ate away at her muscles. I can't remember the exact name of it. But he used to carry her up and down the stairs. Mm. And he made it a, you know, part of his mission to get in shape so that he could help his wife. And then to that, he just got interested in Ninja Warrior and trained. He completed the course, which was amazing. He'd never, you know, done the course, never competed on the show before. And there wasn't a dry eye in the control room. There wasn't a dry eye in the crowd. I mean, it was amazing. And it was just, you know, it's the story of human spirit and what you can achieve and what drives us to do certain things, you know. Mm-hmm. Whenever you're passionate about something, whenever, you know, you have a purpose, nothing will stop you from achieving your goals or your dreams. And I think that's part of the message of the show.
Absolutely. Is there a certain archetype for a successful contestant? Because I feel like watching it, my kids and I think whenever there's a gymnast, I'm inclined to believe, okay, they're going to nail it. Like they're probably going to win the whole thing.
Every time we think there's an archetype for it, it gets changed.
Yeah.
Someone blows it out of the water. So there really isn't. I will say that, you know, if you're of slim build and you don't weigh a lot, your weight ratio to height is, you know, like you tend to do better. You have a better chance with it because you're not carrying so much weight around. But then that gets blown out of the water when we have someone like Grant McCarthy, who's 220 pounds and
yeah,
he kills the course. So, and makes it up the mega wall, you know. So, and even Akbar Bajabiamila did the Celebrity Ninja Warrior a couple of years ago. And, you know, he's 6'7".
Yeah.
And he completed the course. And so there is no real archetype. We used to say, I remember back in a while when we went from, you know, there was the people doing parkour, and then there was people doing CrossFit, and then the rock climbers showed up, and everybody said, oh, it's rock climbers. Rock climbers are going to, and I would say that, it, you know, the leaner you are, or, you know, it's about being in shape. And it's also about having multiple skill sets.
Mm, okay.
So you have to have grip strength, you have to have upper body strength, you have to have balance and agility. And it's as much a mental game as anything else. Being under the lights, competing in anything, you know, when it's showtime, that's when the mental game comes in. And that's when, you know, your mental toughness shows up. And, you know, you can get lost in overthinking things, and you can make silly mistakes, and you can rush, or you can get ahead of yourself on obstacles. It's, you know, they say it in in professional sports all the time. You know, when you ask professional players about it, basketball or football, so what do you think about the playoffs coming up? They no, we're just playing this game right now. This is the game you have right now. And it's the same with Ninja. You really have to focus on the obstacle you're on with a big plan, of course. So, you know, and the people that do the best are the people that execute the best, the people that are really streamlined with their approach and, you know, preserve their energy. So that's the people that really perform the best.
And do you think it helps or hinders contestants when they start by, and they seem a little bombastic, like, or they're dancing around, because it drives us crazy because we're just like, focus, focus, get ready. Are you behind the scenes yelling like we are as we watch the show?
Well, we have said that before. It's like someone does backflips up the front start line and does all these. It's like, you might want to save some of that energy for the court.
But, yeah, exactly.
But I also see the value in it too. I see, you know, just like any pro athlete that gets pumped up before a match, or, you know, they get hyped, they get that energy going. It's, you know, that energy is what helps get them going.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you have no passion and no energy and you go, okay, I'm going to do the course now. I think it doesn't deliver the same, regardless of what it does for TV. I don't think it does the same thing for you inside.
Yeah.
So you know, you want to get your vibrations up, your energy up, and be pumped for it. So that's the way some of the people do it. I mean, everybody has a different way of doing it.
Are you at ever paralyzed by, or at least I would be, maybe I'm projecting, concern that someone's going to get injured? And have you ever had somebody that had an injury where you're like, oh no, I hope that they can still compete?
Yeah. You know, injury is always something that, you know, you have to be aware of and consider in every sport. And Ninja Warrior is no different. We take enormous measures, safety measures, to make sure that doesn't happen. And when we're designing the obstacles, when we're fine-tuning the obstacles, safety is our number one concern, always. But someone could fall wrong, someone could do something, you know, that always happened. But thankfully, we've never had any super serious injuries. We've had, you know, I think the most serious injury was Travis Rosen in the Las Vegas finals a few years ago when he landed wrong on the pad and crushed his ankle. But we have a couple of dislocated shoulders, and that's, you know, twisted, you know, ankles, stuff like that. Not any seriously hurt or anything like that. No, you know, concussions or anything. Everything's padded, and we pad all the places that are padded. We, you know, try and make sure, we really do endeavor to make sure that it's safe. We had an incident just this last season in the finals, or not in the finals. It was in the semifinals. And we lowered the age to 15. So it's a big year because it's the young guns are coming in, 15 to 19. It used to be 19. Now it's 15, 16, 17, 18 year olds can compete. And they came in and they just blew away the course. When they got to some of them get to the end of the course. I don't want to do any spoilers, but because you'll see it on the show, but when they went through the spider climb, there's these two doors, which you have to push up one at a time and then go spider your way up. One of them was using their head to push up the doors.
Oh, like boy. Yeah.
And there's an issue with that. Now, so we stopped everything. I ran out there. I said, this is way too dangerous, guys, because I got someone to demonstrate why it was dangerous to these young guys. I said, listen, if you're going up this wall and you put your head through there and your foot slips, where does your head go?
Oh, God.
Wall collapses. And
yeah.
It's like, guys, the show is not important enough for me to lose any of you or injure any of you. I'll stop production right now. If anybody does that, they're out. They're disqualified. So you don't want to ruin your run by going all the way and then do something silly. Make good choices. Be smart. You know, you've been told that since you're a kid. So it shouldn't. So because of that, we made a rule, but then we came up with a new design, which will be implemented next season that will prevent them from even being able to do that.
Mm.
So, but we're always, safety is our number one concern. And absolutely, that's paramount. And the ninjas know that too. They know we think about them and we care about them. I care about them. I mean, many of them are my friends. So I care about them like my family. And that's what I told them. I think of you as my kids, you know, and I would do the same of my kid. I would not put them in danger.
Well, it's a great show. I mean, we love to watch it at our house. But moving to another crazy show, your executive producer and, I believe, a co-creator of Hell's Kitchen with Gordon Ramsay. which is also a huge hit. And people obsess over this show, and for good reason, because he's such a character. And the dynamics of the show, the way that it's set up, are so interesting. Where did the concept come from?
It started in England. And there was a season, there was one season in England, in the UK. It was by ATV. And Arthur and I were fairly young in our company. This was back in 2003 or four. I think the show aired in 2004, so it was 2003. And Mike Darnell, who was running Fox at the time, sent us some tapes of this guy, Gordon Ramsay, sent us the show that they did in the UK, which was, it was Gordon in the kitchen with chefs. And there was like this maitre d' who was like a host, and it was like this live thing. And he was, you know, doing live commentary, and it was very, very different. And they would cook, and but it wasn't very interesting. It wasn't, you know, it was just kind of a bizarre way to do it. And we were like, I don't know, but we saw some tape of Gordon and Kitchen Nightmares. And I remember going to my partner, Arthur, and said, Arthur, this stuff of Gordon and Kitchen Nightmares is pretty impressive. He's pretty amazing. And you didn't really get the sense of that in the first Hell's Kitchen we saw that they did in the UK. And so we told Mike, Arthur, and said, Mike, well, yeah, we'll take it. Arthur and I decided we'll take it on. And we created a format, which was about real chefs in the real world wanting to up their level and wanting to see if they could make it as a head chef, you know, and prove that they were worthy of making it as a head chef. So what we did is we took real people. It wasn't just a reality show about contestants coming to cook for Gordon Ramsay. It was a show about real people with real jobs in the real world, you know, wanting to, you know, chase their dreams. So right then you have a dynamic of people that, you know, they don't care about TV. They care about cooking for Chef Ramsay, and he's their idol. And this is their way to get to the next level. And we shot the first series, and you know, that there was always issues in the first, you know, season of a shoot. And that's when we got to know Gordon really well. And, you know, I remember shooting a segment on Hollywood Boulevard with Gordon and walking around with him and doing these like interviews, you know, it was like a tasting thing. The chefs had some cooked something and ran people taste it. And Gordon would say, what did you think of that? What did you think of that? Nobody knew who Gordon was. I mean, he could walk down the street and he was just some guy in a white jacket.
Yeah.
With his accent. But, you know, now today he would be swamped. You know,
oh,
swarmed,
absolutely.
Sorry, he'd be swarmed and swamped with people. But the interesting about the first season is I think we did 14 cuts of the first episode. Gail Berman, who was heading up Fox at the time, you know, said, I don't know about the show. We had notes back and forth. Do it this way. Put music in. Don't put music in. Add VO. Don't put VO in. And really, Fox really didn't have a lot of, you know, hope for it or faith, you know, in the show. They put it, they debuted it on Memorial Day, and it got a number. It did really well, and it surprised everybody. And it was the first cooking show or cooking reality show or cooking competition show. I think there was another show called The Restaurant.
With Rocco DiSpirito.
Rocco, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that show took off, and I believe the difference was in large part to the format. And what I mean by the format that we did different is we put people in situations. We create a structure for the reality to happen. We don't come in and produce reality moments. We put people in, you know, stressful situations and situations where it's going to, you know, bring out the reality. Their true persons, the true, you know, image, the true characters are going to come out. And, you know, when you put a bunch of people in a dorm and that don't know each other for 30 days, after about 2 or 3 days, their real, you know, side comes out. You see the real person. So, and I think that's what really resonated with the audience, is that they, a lot of people saw themselves in that, you know, or they would marvel at, you know, the characters. And, but they had, these characters had a, you know, they all had a vision, a dream. All of them believed they could win. And, you know, some of them are delusional, but, some, you know, we all have delusions. We all have delusions of grandeur. So, and then we just created really interesting, fun challenges, too, that tested their skills. And it was very purposeful. The challenges we came up with were always very purposeful. Everything we did was with a purpose. And it's the execution of the format and the producing of it that I think really resonates and has made the show, you know, fun to watch. interesting to watch, entertaining. It was, you know, dramatic. It was, there were obviously moments when, you know, where we thought, you know, oh, something's going wrong. What do you got to jump in there? And
well, I think what the question that most people want to know is whether or not Gordon is a lunatic in real life, as he seems sometimes on the show. I mean, I saw an episode and someone even brought it up to me where he took two sandwich, like pieces of bread or a bagel or something, and put it between a woman's head and called her an idiot sandwich. Like, this kind of character in real world circumstances, you'd be like, why would anybody speak to him, let alone want to work for him? Is he like that in real life? And does he ever look at episodes and go, maybe I took a little too far?
You know, it's a funny thing. And I always equate this to, there's a similarity between producing and what Gordon does as a chef in the kitchen and a producer or director in my case, and or in both cases, I should say. But, you know, I remember, especially as a young director, that when you have a task and your crew is supposed to do something, and they know what they're supposed to do, and you've given them instructions, and they know what to do, and they mess up, you're like, have you lost it? What the heck's going on? And so I actually could relate to him. In the moment, when you're doing a live show and someone messes up, you're like, no, you get crazy about it. I think Gordon in the kitchen is that. He is so intense and so in the present and living in the moment, and the pressure of doing a live dinner service, and he feels it. He takes it on personally. So is he like that in real life? No, he's not. He is probably the most charming person you'd ever meet. I mean, he is, you know, very gentle and friendly, and but with his team, with his crew, as a business owner and as a boss, he's tough. But he has expectations of his people because he demands the best. They know that, and they want to do the best. So I think that's, and I also think the world's evolved a lot since, you know, 16 years ago, but we're 17 years ago now. And there, you know, I think we see less of the, we went through a phase with Gordon once where it's like, you can't touch the contestants. Okay. No touching the contestants. Okay. Cause as we evolved and, you know, the world changed in a gentler, kindler world. And you know, we evolved with it. And he can still get upset. He can still get mad. He can still yell. He can still, you know, wreak havoc on them and set them straight, you know, and get them back in line. But no touch.
So when it stops filming, is he joking with them? And does he keep in touch with a lot of these contestants?
He's always
afterwards?
Their boss. On the always show, he's the always boss. The boss. He's Got always it. The boss. No, and like anything that whenever we are upset about something, any of us in our lives are upset about anything, it stays with us for a little bit. You know, it doesn't just go away. And, you know, he'll come back and say, did you see what he did? Did you see what was that guy thinking? That's like insane. I can't believe he was doing that. We had to ruin the whole thing. And this, and so just, and I totally empathize with that, because I think all of us, you know, experience that in our lives in some way or another, you know, and we'll go tell someone else. Did you see what they did? That was crazy. And so lives with one, and then he gets over it. But you know, ultimately he cares about them very much, and he wants them to do their best, and he expects them to do their best. Mm. So he's a tough boss, and he's tough love.
Why so many beef Wellingtons and risottos? Is that just like the standard? So many people want to ask that. Many beef Wellingtons.
Yeah, well, the beef Wellington is kind of a trademark, you know, of Gordon. And you know, I think it's the lack of understanding comes from not even tasting one. If you ever tasted one, then you would know. And he's very, very, you know, good about charities and donating his time and, mm-hmm. and energy. I remember there was a charity that reached out to us, and it might have been Dream Foundation. And there was a man that had a wish and is dying to have a beef Wellington, and they planned to fly to Las Vegas mm-hmm. where we were filming, and to get, to have a dinner at Hell's Kitchen. And then he got too sick.
Oh no!
And they reached out to me, and I went to Gordon and said, I don't think he's going to make it, Gordon. I don't think he's going to make it here. And so what Gordon did is he cooked himself. He went in the kitchen, cooked a beef Wellington with the potatoes, and they they midnight shipped it overnight. They air freight, you know, you put it on a plane and send it to him overnight. So he got to eat the beef Wellington. And this was, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of character that Gordon is. He's very generous and very caring.
And you did tell me that he is probably the busiest person you know.
Yeah, he's very, very busy.
Like has no time at all, yeah. Which is surprising. Well, not surprising, but he has a big family like I do too.
Right. I think that Gordon has done a great job of making, weaving his family into his career too. And I think, you know, probably like myself, I mean, I really, you know, got a lot of value out of COVID. I mean, I got to spend more time with my family probably than I have in the last 10 years. And I think he did too. I mean, listen, we all suffered from, you know, financially or other areas, you know, our life that, you know, because of it. And he's no different. But I know that the benefits reaped from spending time with your family is probably exponentially more worth in your life. So, and I know he spent a lot of time with his new son, Oliver, and really enjoying that time, and him and Tilly are making, you know, TikToks and Instagrams all the time. Yeah, he's having a good time.
Has this show ruined it for you though, going to a restaurant? In other words, are you very picky about the way food's prepared, the way it tastes? Do you feel like you have a degree adjacent in the culinary arts?
Well, it would be impossible to say you don't learn anything because you learn a ton from him.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially in the earlier seasons, we actually got to taste the food. A lot of the food didn't make it out to the diners, and some of the food would come back to the control room and we get to taste it. And it you know, it is amazing. It is a whole nother level.
Yeah.
It's, I would say I don't become critical or, you know, but I do know this. I know the difference, you know, and I'll go, well, this is overcooked or this is, you know, doesn't have seasoning. Or this. But, you know, I've been to restaurants with Gordon many times too, and he never says anything.
Well, no, because he's been there before.
He never says anything to a chef. He's never says, this is shit, this is crap, right. Take this away. Yeah. No, he's always very kind and that's very, you know, it's very thoughtful of him to do that. And even though he knows it's crap. So,
right.
I will say when we were doing Kitchen Nightmares, which we did over 100 episodes of with Gordon, prior to doing Kitchen Nightmares, I had always dreamed of opening a restaurant.
Really?
Wouldn't it be fun to open a restaurant and cook and, you know, have people out and entertain them? And after doing Kitchen Nightmares, it was like, no way.
No way. Yeah.
Just not going to do it. I mean, although I probably know how to do it now. I know what pitfalls to look for and what mistakes not to do. So.
Well, I'm not going to let you go without touching on two ridiculously amazing shows of the past that you worked on, Trading Spaces and Paradise Hotel. So I need you to tell me two things, one from each show, that people would be surprised to know about Paradise Hotel and Trading Spaces. Because I've probably watched every single episode of both shows.
Okay. Well, Trading Spaces, we sort of inherited, which is great. Because we got to play with take another format and see what we could do to reinvigorate it. Paige was an absolute doll to work with, and she was amazing. I think that the one thing that people may be surprised about Trading Spaces is how difficult the transformations were. And it came down to the wire almost every time.
It seemed like it, yeah.
I mean, it was really, really, really crazy. I mean, I don't know how we pulled it off sometimes, or I don't know how they pulled it off even, but you know, the designers were always very funny, you know, off camera. I mean, they're funny on camera too, but they made us laugh a lot. Paradise Hotel, man, there are so many stories. That was show. Originally that show was 15 episodes. And then when we were shooting in the middle of the run, Fox ordered another 15.
Oh, wow.
So I was directing that one also. So in between, I directed, you know, down in Mexico, and I directed in LA too, the live portion. And I was flying back and forth. We shot it in Acapulco. I don't know if everybody knows that yet, but we shot it at a private residence in Acapulco. but that looked like a hotel. It was that big of a
hotel. It did look like a hotel.
It was a big, big place. But I'll never forget when I had to go down there and have a meeting with everybody. And, you know, they're thinking the season's coming to an end, you know, and they're going to be here another week. And I said, so how'd you guys feel about staying another couple months?
Oh, my God.
And they were like, what? So there was that. And then probably something I don't think very many people know was we actually had to stop production in the middle of the run because they were basically revolting. They said, like, no more. We're not doing this anymore. So we had to stop for, like, not long. I think it was, you know, maybe 24, 36 hours at the most. So we had to stop, talk to everybody. I met with them, each one, all the cast individually, me and Charles, who was the other EP with me down on the set. And you know, we got it back on track.
Yeah.
You know, just but it's not, you know, listen, it's not unreasonable to think that that would happen when you're, you know, it's like you're Lord of the Flies down there. And it's like, you're living in a whole alternate reality at some point because it becomes your reality. And it's a lot of pressure, a lot of stress, and a lot of cameras, and it was also one of the first times that I think a show used the hidden cameras so widely. And we built the first multi-camera control room that everybody uses now, and used fiber optics. It was like the first time we ever used fiber optics, and it kind of built this whole master control room, which became the same thing that we used, you know, for many other shows to come, including Hell's Kitchen.
Oh my God, it was so good. Do you ever go to bed with the sound of her saying Yahtzee in your head?
No.
Oh my God.
I do go to the sound of Maja Day in my head. I don't know if you
yeah.
I survived a Japanese game show. We lived in Japan for a while, but yeah. So I do hear Maja Day in my head once in a while.
So funny. Well, this has been awesome. Tell everybody where they can watch American Ninja Warrior and Hell's Kitchen, which are such great shows.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Monday nights on NBC is American Ninja Warrior, and Monday nights on Fox is Hell's Kitchen. We actually air both shows on the same night.
Do you have anything?
Not by our choice or choosing.
Do you have anything else in the pipeline that we should know about coming up?
Nothing I can talk about right now.
Okay.
There's some cool stuff coming, but, yeah, it's all still too early to mention.
Okay, good. Well, listen, thank you so much, and I'll see you at the beach this summer.
Absolutely.
I want to thank my fantastic guests, Kent and Jay. Remind you to click subscribe and leave a 5-star review, which is always so helpful. Join the Reality Life with Kate Casey Facebook group. Talk about this episode and others and what you're watching each week. Again, that's Reality Life with Kate Casey in Facebook. You can find me on Twitter at Kate Casey. I tweet about shows and during shows all week long. My Instagram is at Kate Casey CA. You can see what I'm watching each week and a little window into what's going on in my life each week. And you can find my must-watch list on my Substack page, which is a newsletter that will come to you every Monday with my list of what to watch. Go to katecasey.substack.com. You can also find me on TikTok at It's Kate Casey, on Patreon with bonus episodes, more episodes for you at patreon.com/KateCasey. And you can also find me on Clubhouse at Kate Casey. I'm wishing you all a great week, and I can't wait to circle back with you on Friday.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.